in brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust and blues you can trust. Indigos feel and white ones heal. Yellow scare and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bulkelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 562.
That's right. What is on the docket tonight?
GL June, our part, the conclusion, the end of the 2024 GL June saga. Brought to you by Chad Bulkelman in more ways than one.
This turd Thanks, was Chad. Brought to you by...
Thank you, Mother Chad. Thanks, Chad.
Look, it's not the best crossover, and we'll talk about it, but there's reasons, guys. There's reasons. This is a forewarning, guys. We might talk about it a little bit towards the end of everything, but we're not going to fully recap everything that happened in the first part, New Titans 124, or in Green Lantern, or in Dark Stars, or in Damage, or any of that stuff. We're talking about our issue, the New Titans 125. Naturally, of course, we're going to be talking about the event as a whole because we wrap up this whole thing. So, yes, there's going to be some coverage of that, but no actual recap. So if you want the full story, you need to listen to the whole crossover event, GL June, New Titans 124, covered over on Emerald Echo by Adam and Donnie over on the Multiverse Musings Podcast Network. Just look for them on YouTube. Then our friends Myron and Phil did the Green Lantern coverage over on Podcast of Oa. Dan over at Mosaic Comics did the Dark Stars coverage. Our friend Will did it over did the Damage coverage over on Green Lantern's podcast, which is on YouTube and Spotify. Interestingly enough, we are the only ones, without a YouTube channel, in terms of we don't post our episodes over on YouTube. I might do something for this. I might not. I don't want to lock myself in, but I might try my hand at it at the very least for this episode. It may not be up the same time this actual audio comes out, but I plan on doing just a little something because it does feel, at least to me, a little weird for everybody else to have a YouTube video and we ask all those listeners to just switch platforms and go to Spotify instead or Apple Podcasts or any of that other stuff. So I will do my best to put something, even if it's just the audio on our YouTube channel with just the Lantern Cast logo on it. I'll try to be a little more detailed than that, but before I get too lost there. yes, we are talking about the event from 95, 96. I think it went into both years, right?
Cover date for this is September 95.
Okay. So yeah, this is just 95 then. This is the crossover event, the Siege of the Zsharam or Zsharam or whatever. I like Sharam. It sounds more cosmic, but whatever. So we're just going to jump right into this, and I'm going to recap as concisely as I can.
Bless you.
We open our story over at Titans headquarters over in New Jersey, where a woman named Annie, who we got introduced to earlier on in the story as a Dark Star coordinator for Donna Troy, she is there looking after things at the headquarters with her two sons, Thomas and Benjamin. Her ex-husband is there trying to take the children away from her at gunpoint. He gets knocked on the head and disarmed with his weapon by Rose. And Rose is actually Rose Wilson. This is Deathstroke's daughter. She holds him at gunpoint while Annie goes to call the cops. Meanwhile, back in space, The Titans have just finished collecting a bunch of pieces for a weapon that the Council of Zeeshiram, and Zeeshiram is essentially a solar system, a bunch of different planets with different species and stuff, kind of a collective of different races have come together to form a council, and it's the Zeeshiram system, or so whatever we want to. It's either a local area of a galaxy or as condensed as a solar system, but a council of aliens. Has come up with an idea for a weapon to stop the progenitors, which is a race of parasitic-like creatures that are kind of spreading across the galaxy. They consume everything in their path as fuel to reproduce, and they kind of try and put everybody into submission. They had come up with a weapon. The Titans had previously split into teams to go find these pieces. Well, now they have figured out that these pieces were intended to actually sterilize the progenitors. And that would mean that the progenitors that are currently existing would be the last generation. And therefore, we would be committing genocide by allowing this plan to commence. So the Zeeshiram wants to destroy the progenitors. The progenitors wants to destroy the Zeeshiram. The Titans are stuck in the middle. They don't want to do either of these two things, but they cannot let genocide happen on their watch. So they are stuck in the middle of this war, fighting both sides at this point. At some point, Arsenal, who's down on the ground, comes up with a plan and starts radioing it to others to stop these missiles that they have created that would sterilize the progenitor race, and gets Kyle and them to bring them, some of them, back down to the atmosphere and detonate it above the races so that it kind of spreads throughout the atmosphere and onto the alien inhabitants. And because the aliens, it's only targeted to progenitors, it'll spread to everyone, including the Titans themselves, and everybody will be infected that they come into contact with, and therefore it'll affect, because it's a council, when they go back to their home worlds and so on and so forth, it'll spread. So the idea is that Arsenal had come up with is to, since it's harmless to all other races, to infect everybody and basically tell the progenitors, look, you can continue this whole thing, but if you come down here, you're going to die. And if you attack any of us, you're going to die. So he basically put the decision in their hands and they can't risk it. So they turn tail and run. And after they fix the situation and kind of make everybody understand their way and everybody's got a happy ending and Donna and Kyle share a nice kiss and so on and so forth, a gravity well, the one that appeared in our first issue in Titan New Titans 124 outside of Jupiter, appears again and brings them back to our solar system just above Earth, between Earth and the moon. And everybody goes home happy. The end, except for apparently this gravity well was created by somebody specifically, and they specifically intentionally sent the Titans to Zeeshiram to deal with this as a test of some kind. We don't know what that is because I wasn't reading the Titans, and we're covering this issue, not what comes after. So I didn't bother to follow up on that, but I assume it has something to do with the rest of this series. And I know Simon and some of the other DC villains were big in the Titans at the time. So maybe this is Simon or somebody working for him or something, but that is the final issue. All ends happily as can be.
Good night, everybody. Nice, Chad. We can go to bed at a decent time.
That's the best I could do it. I will say, the script is Marv Wolfman. The pencils by William Rosato. Inks, Keith Champagne. Colors by Chris Mathis. And letters by Albert de Guzman.
I will say, at least this is topical in a way, just because we had just been talking about Robert Venditti. A lot, apparently. I've been talking about Robert Venditti and the way his things tend to go off the rails, and that Dark Star arc was the classic example of such a good idea, but he only wanted to approach it one way, so it became clear that the more interesting way to deal with the issue was not going to be dealt with. The best thing about this issue is that at least there's some, I do like stories that have a big moral quandary in them. And at least this issue does give us that. It's the fact that, okay, the progenitors are a crap. They deserve to be stopped. That number one, half the team here thinks that basically the crime more than fits the punishment, and whatever, if this, that A, they deserve it anyway, and B, this might be the only way we can stop them anyway. So why, you know, so let's just let them get their just desserts. And then you know, Donna, among other people, is like, well, you can't do that. It's like, you know, I just can't sign off on this. But you still have the moral question about what they're doing here. And it's like, it's a virus. They created a virus. It's just, you know, with the sole intent of stopping the progenitors. It's not going to hurt anybody else. But I do like the fact that there is that moral question all throughout the issue. And then at the end, the acknowledgement that, you know, when the aliens pretty much thank Kyle and company and everybody, going, well, we thank you basically because your solution was actually better than doing the basically infecting the rest of the universe with the virus, which has no impact on them whatsoever because it's not designed for them. Essentially, it's like they have natural immunity since it's not designed for them anyway. But by everybody coming into contact with the virus, that means the progenitors, if they come to any of these people try to continue their invading, murdering ways, they're going to be infected, and boom, boom, boom. Then they're going to pay the price that they would have paid anyway, even if they were, you know, they themselves were infected with the virus in this issue. Mm-hmm. I thought that was so. I like that. I thought. Now, did I really like the story? No, not really. I will say the first issue and the last issue, which were both Titans, right? They were both Titans. Those issues I liked. From a bookend perspective, I think the event kind of works that way, because I did like the setup, because the setup was the only issue that I had read previously before I read all the rest of these prepping for our, you know, our issue. So I did think they bookended well, that, you know, as we've discussed before in talking about this event in general terms, that it's a very eclectic, weird group of characters all being jammed together. So that,
yeah,
that,
and for those of you playing along at home, because I didn't mention it, but and a lot of you should have listened to the recaps thus far, but just in case, we have Donna Troy Darkstar, Kyle Rayner Green Lantern, Bart Allen Impulse is not in our issue, but he's a part of this here and there because he was left behind. We have Arsenal, we have Terra, we have the Grant Emerson version of Damage. We have a character named Jarrus, who is known as Minion, and Mary, aka Mirage. And also we have Supergirl, who is the, at the time, protoplasmic shapeshifty version of Supergirl that we saw during Death of Superman.
Yes, which of course is not my favorite version of Supergirl at all, but still. So because it is such a weird ragtag group of characters thrown together, and so with some of the interpersonal dynamics that exist, like Kyle and Donna and other relationships between different members of that, it does create an interesting dynamic, which I think does help the story. And obviously, I think it also helps the conflict, like we talked about in this issue, the fact that there's so much moral ambiguity about, you know, the gray area between what's right and wrong here to solve the problem. I think on those basic levels, I think it is successful, I think. So
do you think it's fair to call the progenitors basically, they're the aliens from Independence Day? They find new worlds, they destroy everything in their path, they consume all the resources for themselves, and then they move on to the next one.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair to say, which is kind of funny because I actually finally watched Resurgence couple of weeks ago.
You've never seen it?
No, because I was never a fan of the first movie. So I know you were excited about the second one. That's what made me think about it, because it popped up on Tubi. So that's why I watched it in its entirety.
Excited is not necessarily the right word. Here's the thing. Is it the director or the writer? I don't know who it is. He's the same guy who did Moonfall.
Yeah, Emmerich. It's Emmerich. I think it's Emmerich.
And so the end of Resurgence, spoilers, I guess, is basically like, you know, this other alien species is helping Earth attack, or rather has come to Earth because Earth is one of the only ones who's been able to stave off this swarm of, I don't even know what these aliens are supposed to be called in Independence of the Universe, but whatever. And like, it kind of ends with like an invitation for Earth to help all the other worlds take on this thing. And then Moonfall, which is not connected to the Independence of the Universe, ends with the same sort of thing, like Earth stepping onto a larger stage. And it's very clear that Emmerich wants to tell this fucking story and nobody's letting him, either based on box office scores or like whatever. Like, nobody's letting him. He wants to tell something about Earth stepping onto the larger stage, but he can't get there because none of his stuff succeeds enough.
I'm trying to make, yeah, Roland Emmerich, that's who I thought.
Yeah.
Roland Emmerich, I think, as in the Roland Emmerich and Dean Devlin, I think they were the classic Godzilla 1998 team. Disaster movies are their thing. They're kind of like the Irwin Allen and everybody else of the of modern gen. I think Moonfall, at least I thought Moonfall was better. But the point is not to end this tangent quickly. The reality is, I had never seen the sequel before, and man, that made the first one look like The Godfather. That's all I have to say. It was really a piece of crap. I think your analogy with the aliens here, I think, is pretty dead on. So that's why it makes it really difficult to just completely dismiss the idea or say, oh, what they're trying to do to stop the progenitors is wrong. It's like, they're really not. It's just it's desperate times call for desperate measures. And if you're dealing with somebody who isn't going to stop unless you force them to stop, if this is the way they, you know, would it have been any less moral if it was a virus that would kill anyone of their species that came into contact with the virus like within 24 hours? So, and counting, or let's say, let's give it a little more time than that. Let's say 36 to 72 hours. So because you purposely like ants eating poison from a trap, you want to make sure they bring it back to the nest to wipe out the nest too. That, would that be any more morally questionable as opposed to doing what they did? I don't know. I appreciated the quandary. I didn't think it was so, it was not a black and white decision, but it raised enough to make me think, okay, I appreciate that they went down that road to make it a little less.
It made enough sense.
Yeah. And again, it kind of flowed naturally. So it wasn't like the Robert Venditti thing where it's like, yeah, the Dark Star is lethal force versus non-lethal force. This would have been like if they had in that story arc where you had Hal and some other Green Lanterns either in the issue, somewhere in the issues or at the very end going, you know, we won, but I don't entirely think they were entirely wrong. But at least you get some of that in the story, but you certainly didn't get that in the Dark Stars arc. So I think this was handled better.
Yeah, the especially the whole like, let's split up and go get these components for the weapon thing, that was unnecessarily drug out, I thought. But that's not our issue. But like, I do agree with some of the coverage in that regard, because I know they were talking about that. But I will say, also in the Dark Stars issue, how they insisted on dedicating a couple of those pages to continuing the current arc in the Dark Stars story that was happening within the actual series itself. I can't straddle the fence here, because I often say, like, if a series I'm actively reading starts doing a crossover and I'm just sort of taken completely out of the story I was invested in, literally invested in, my money is going towards the series because I like it, want to continue reading it, I too would want to continue to see some connection to the story I'm familiar with in this crossover story, at the very least, in some way. So, but you know, I can only be honest and say that reading the event in the event only, that it did feel weird from that perspective. But I can't fault that Dark Stars issue for that, because it did what I would want if I were an active reader at the time.
Right. I get that.
So why did I want to choose this? Oh, actually, you know, before we even get to that, you want to talk a bit about some of the art or any of the storytelling from or the details from our specific issue? I thought the art of our issue was actually probably one of the strongest of the crossover.
Yeah, generally speaking, the art was... See, I don't know. It's a fine line. I don't think the art was particularly great in most of these issues, but there are some characters that are drawn well in this issue, I would agree. But there are also some panels that are really drawn, and characters, sometimes it's the same character on different pages, that are drawn really weird. So I can't entirely say that I thought the art was an overall strength in this story, let alone this issue. But, and the cover, it's like, well, the good news is Kyle is, it's a Kyle-centric front cover, but Kyle looks like crap. So so he's not drawn particularly well. But he's drawn...
Double-page spread.
So there are some pages in the issue that, you know, he looks really goofy in that close-up on, like, page 22, but he looks fine on page 23 when he's with Donna. So I don't know. I think the art is a little bit of a mixed bag overall. I don't think it, and I don't mean this really, it's going to come out negative. I don't mean it that negative. It doesn't erase some of the other sins of the story. Mm. Like sometimes art can do, or at least make you go that, yeah, you know, but on the bright side, like we kind of joked around not that long ago when I joked around with you, like you're that tends to be your take. And they're, well, but the art is good. It's like, I don't know if this meets that threshold to say, well, yeah, there's holes in the story, but the art's so solid that you kind of, it's like no. The story itself. It's good. It's acceptable to good, but it's, I don't know if I'd say either are memorable.
Well, yeah. So like, and I'll point out a couple of things. So there's the point where the progenitors start attacking the surface again. And like Tara puts on her goggles and talks to Arsenal and says, you know, what then, Hotshot? Like what that, one of the first couple of pages, she looks really well drawn in that particular panel. And then we go to the next, after that, a few pages when Tara is actually with Damage instead, and she starts using her Tara powers, and he's like, you're amazing. And she's like, yeah, I am, aren't I? Her face looks pretty great there too. But if you go the very next page and they're on the asteroid and she says, hang on, cutie, we're hauling asteroid. She looks really strange there. So there's a couple of points where characters look like the page where Donna is looking up saying Titans, this is Darkstar. This is the same page where Kyle makes the Pteranodon construct. She looks almost masculine there.
Yeah, she does.
But she looks very beautiful in some of the other spots that we see her. Speaking of Tara, when she's coming out of her unconsciousness and Damage is holding her in his arms and they get a really close up of their face, that looks really, really good. So there are moments that are pretty great artistically, but I can't fault, you know, seeing some of the parts where maybe we pull back a little bit and we're not as zoomed in, so we don't get as much detail in the panel. So it faults, it defaults to more simple lines and it doesn't quite work as well. So I can see that.
Shaky, some solid, some not. But again, it's kind of, like I said, it doesn't stand out one way or the other. So it's kind of, in a way, it's like it's fitting, I guess we would have to say, for the story.
Yeah, I will say so. Well, let's talk a bit about why I chose this. So I had mentioned it in a prior episode of ours, but is this the best Kyle Rayner story ever? No. Is this one of the best Kyle Rayner crossovers ever? No. Is this one of the best Titans crossovers ever? No. But there's something very unique in the timing of this story. Titans, the book, failing in sales. Damage, the book, failing in sales. Dark Stars, also. All three of which, by the way, all three of which those series end fairly soon after this story arc. As a matter of fact, New Titans only has one more story arc before the series as a whole ends. So they're doing what they can to save failing books and see if there's any interest and all that stuff. So no, we're not going to get the pinnacle of storytelling in moments like that. Sometimes those can be magical moments that bring really creative storytelling, because we've talked about that before, like in the history of Green Lantern sales are dipping. And then We have Julie Schwartz that says, you know, hey, Neil Adams, Denny O'Neill, what you got? Do whatever the hell you feel like. And we get Hard Traveling Heroes, which for better or worse, in some critics' eyes, doesn't matter. It puts Green Lantern back on the map for a while. So it's possible for moves to save a series to have incredible storytelling. This is not one of those. But this is a weird time for Kyle. Look, have I read all of Dark Stars or anything like that? No, I've read a couple of issues here and there. Never read Damage. Couple of issues of New Titans because of that Simon Says thing, right?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
So I have a couple of issues of them here and there. And I'll be honest, after completing my Guy Gardner Warrior run, my eyes are now tuned to collecting Dark Stars and then collecting Kyle specific issues. Like, you know, Kyle has joined the Titans and up until the time he leaves the Titans or the series ends, whichever. I do want to do that at some point. But Kyle is only, what, a year into his tenure as a Lantern? Year and a half, maybe?
That's about right.
So he's still a relative newbie. The only kind of big crossover we saw him in, a couple of two issue things here and there, right? Did Parallax View happen by this point? I believe it had.
Yes.
And the Simon Says stuff happened much earlier. So a couple of two issue things here and there. But other than that, his only real focus in terms of introduction to the larger DCU, you know, and a big story was just Zero Hour. But Zero Hour has fucking everybody in it, and there's so much focus spread to so many different characters.
Not Batman.
Yeah, and there's so many people, and your main villain is fucking Hal by the end of it. Spoilers.
Well, I was just gonna say that, spoiler alert.
But so of course you're gonna focus on whoever the hell has the ring at that point, or a ring. But let's be honest, even if with the Zero Hour epilogue and everything, that's not necessarily something you would go, man, that was a Kyle-centric story or whatever. And not, this isn't either. But even today, I don't mean today because it's not like Jeremy Adams is writing him this way, but within the past decade, okay, last 10 years or so, we still have seen those moments of Kyle being like, hey, am I not worthy? Hell, Rebirth. Hal comes back on the scene and Kyle's like, hey, man, I've just been filling in for you, man. I'm not, you're the real deal. And Hal's like, what the hell do you think you've been doing this whole time? Right. So like even especially at this time, it's so rare to get Kyle confident and in his element. And don't forget, Terra and Damage, maybe Mirage to some extent, Arsenal maybe, although he's a little bit more established. They're not familiar with space, but people like a Dark Star and a Green Lantern, you're on their territory, essentially being in space. So he's in his element, and he seems pretty confident throughout most of this whole thing. Also, in terms of his relationship, he's still got some recovering to do from everything that happened with Alex. Donna's still wary of everything that happened from her divorce. They're not technically together yet. They're flirting and stuff. And obviously by the end of this issue, they kiss, but their relationship isn't really fleshed out until Green Lantern. So you've got Kyle Rayner, who you typically see as uncertain of himself and very even looking to a lot of others for advice on how to be a hero, suddenly just being part of a team and being very confident and competent. He's starting a new relationship and he seems happy to do so. He's very sociable. He's making friends with Supergirl and keeps her secret in that one issue where she reveals her shape-shifting ability. He's very leader-like. And is he like a focus of this story? Not necessarily. But he works so well as an ensemble, and we, especially at this point in Kyle's story, it's so rare to get that. So yeah, does this story have its issues, both plot, scripting, art? Sure. Is it the best? No. But it's such a unique snippet within such a, I don't want to say hated storyline, but an overlooked storyline, that I felt like at some point, Lantern Cast, Podcast of Oa, Emerald Echo, no one's going to look back on this and want to prioritize and go, we should cover the entirety of the Siege of Zsharan, because it would feel maybe like a chore, like something just to do to get it off the checklist. But by splitting it up into one fist across all of us, we spread the pain around a little bit, I guess. But, you know, I don't necessarily mean it as mean as I'm sounding there. But like, I just think that this was the only way to cover this story and see this moment in Kyle Rayner's development, especially for fans who may only be collecting Green Lantern. Because I don't know a whole lot of people who would see a Green Lantern crossover listed in the back issues. Like, yeah, sure, you, myself, Corwin, so on and so forth. We're all kind of completionists. And we're like, oh, we Kyle's in it. We probably got to have it for our long boxes or whatever. But like the average Green Lantern fan who's just collecting Green Lantern, we go, oh, my Green Lantern issue, was it 66, I think, it has part whatever of Z-Sharam. Oh, it's the only Green Lantern issue that's a part of it? Do I want to go get these other four issues? Probably not. So even some regular Green Lantern fans might not have ever read this or even had any desire to read this. But it's such an interesting point for Kyle's life. I thought it's unmissable, and this is the only way for us to do this.
Chad's master plan. As Chad's telling you, it was the castor oil of crossovers, and he got the medicine down. Nice going, Chad. It was the right approach. Splitting it was probably the smart play. Probably, I mean, arguably even the Circle of Fire might have been a wise move for us to split that too, even though that is obviously much more Lantern centric and much more Kyle centric. It makes it easier to spread the wealth in quotes at times around. So it was a worthy journey.
Now, were you reading Green Lantern at the time, obviously, but did you Yes. pick up any part of this? Did you hear, obviously, I know some the answers to some of the questions I'm asking, but like, did you pick up any part of this? Did you hear about it? Did you see the ads in some of the comics?
I think Green Lantern 65 is the only, and I'm going by my recollection of covers, which tends to be pretty strong. I believe that's the only cover clearly that really looked familiar. And plus, since I was reading Green Lantern at the time, unless for some reason you couldn't find that issue, there would be no logical reason why I wouldn't have it. So I'm pretty sure the answer to the question is no. I got Green Lantern because I was getting Green Lantern monthly, and this is probably that was probably all I had, or my understanding or knowledge of the crossover or the storyline until the prep for this event.
What was it like for you reading Green Lantern? Because obviously you weren't picking up all of Titans or whatever. So were there mentions of him being part of the team in the Green Lantern series at the time, or were they pretty much independent things? Because he's obviously established a part of the team of the Titans here.
I think for the most part it was independent. I mean, Donna being in the book opened the door for maybe some direct references to that. But I certainly don't think it was something that came up regularly. I think they kind of kept that at arm's length, I do believe, what I can remember.
How was it with Donna? Because you were only reading Green Lantern, and obviously at the end of this issue, I mean, they share a kiss, and she says, I'm ready to kind of get over Terry and move on from Terry in some way. Did they just suddenly start dating in Green Lantern, or did the Green Lantern make its own thing happen?
What do you mean, make its own thing happen?
In terms of starting their relationship, kicking it off.
I'm still somewhat confused about what you're looking for, direction-wise, what you're looking for from me here.
No, so in this issue, you know, they're flirting, they're going back and forth.
It's much more straightforward, I believe, in Green Lantern when that they were together, from what I remember.
Yeah, the whole team is like, hey, we sense something. What's going on? They're both kind of like, we're taking it slow. It's not ready. And then at the end of the issue, you know, Donna's like, hey, I'm ready to move on. And they share a kiss. And, you know, one presumes they start from there.
Yeah, but it's also the time frames. So, again, I don't remember all the specific when the issues that I'm thinking of. Like, I remember specifically Donna was the one who made the point of telling Kyle that he needed to learn how to defend himself without having the ring. that he shouldn't be dependent just on having the ring, because if something happens to the ring, then what? You need to be able to be more than just the ring. So she tried to emphasize his need for self-defense and learning different and being better on his own, if need be, depowered. So I do remember that conversation, which I think might have been in Central Park, maybe not inappropriately, but yeah.
I will say, speaking of some of the character development that you just mentioned, I will say I actually kind of like that Impulse got left behind with his head in the clouds and stuck in that stupid video game or whatever, because I think it gave some of the other members a minute to shine, because, look, an alien world is getting attacked, which feels very personal to Minion because he's just having gone through that. Terra, for some reason, her abilities are functioning a lot better out here. She has a little bit more power, which is interesting to see what she's doing, how she's developing. With Impulse out of the way, essentially, Damage gets to be a bit more of the reckless one, and all that. Mirage, I don't know that she gets a whole lot to do here. Obviously, like, she's important in terms of some of what happens in getting Arsenal's plan to the rest of the team and all that stuff, but, like, what she does throughout the story, not necessarily. Supergirl, we kind of saw her moment with Kyle and his issue. She's obviously, a big part of the muscle and the power on the team, but in terms of her character development, Arsenal is leading the team, but because of the team gets split apart, Donna is put in like a leadership position. So her giving orders and stuff, that was kind of interesting. And like I've said already over and over again, Kyle being more self-assured and everything than we would normally see him at this point in his development, was fun to see too.
Yeah, I would agree. For a character that is not what he's best known for, that I think it is good to see some of the markers as he moves down the road to being more mature and more confident as a person and as a hero. So I think that's true.
There is something I wanted to read just really briefly. It's just a couple of sentences here, but when I was looking for, like, I was actually trying to figure out who this was in the final panel that was making these gravity wells happen. So I stumbled actually across a blog of one of my friends, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. His name is Tom Panarese, and he does the podcast Pop Culture Affidavit. But like many of these podcasts, they started off as blogs back in the day. And this one is an entry from 2014 when he was talking about he was actually reading the New Titans when he turned 18. This issue storyline came out when he was turning 18. And he says things like, at the time, I thought that this version of the Titans was worth reading. But he's talking about in hindsight how things are a little bit different. And he was explaining why he thought, at least in his 18-year-old brain at the time, he was liking it. And then he's talking a bit about team members and stuff like that. But there's an analogy I thought was interesting about not necessarily Green Lantern, but just the status of this book at the time and what he thought about it, that I thought you would find interesting. So I actually saved the link and I wanted to read it. I think the listeners will find it interesting as well. He says, so I wanted to see this team and I wanted to see it work well, especially since I thought that the lineup change had brought some much needed new life to my favorite comic book. But there was a marked difference between the 1986 world champion New York Mets and the 1990 we surged but came up short New York Mets. Whatever brilliance New Titans was having in the post-Zero Hour era was a, no pun intended, mirage, as my reread of these stories has shown. The dialogue was often clunky, some of the plots were nonsensical, and with the addition of Minion and two space-based heroes, Green Lantern and Darkstar, the book became too science fiction-focused. Had the group spent a few issues taking on villains like Trident, the Brotherhood of Evil, or the Fearsome Five, I think we would have had a chance to see them as heroes and not also Rans.
That's interesting. Again, I don't have enough ties to the Titans one way or the other to make a fair objective assessment of that. But it does seem to be some truth in it, and it does. And I can understand arguably how bringing in Donna and Kyle potentially kind of hijacked the group to a certain extent and kind of made it almost like a foregone conclusion where the stories were going to go, because you have these two really powerful characters that you have to be dealing with bigger threats. Higher, faster, Captain Marvel bullshit. That's that kind of thing. It made sense that they almost had no choice, but nowhere to go but up in this case. So I can understand why that could turn a lot of people off based on who else was on the team prior to that.
I was also wanting to read that. I mean, obviously there's the baseball analogy, which I thought you would enjoy, but I also wanted to say, like, you know, he says the dialogue was clunky. Some of the plots were nonsensical. You know, it became too science fiction focused, so on and so forth, for a book like New Titans with the heroes that it had. I kind of get what he's saying, and we kind of feel that throughout this. So I thought it was a good summary of kind of maybe some of the problems with New Titans at the time that kind of probably would have spilled over into the books that were crossing over with the story arc, because it was so rooted in the New Titans. So I thought that was worth mentioning.
It was a good find.
For sure. All right. Anything else about the Siege of the Zsharam?
Hasta la vista, baby.
Yeah. Look, it was fun. I'm glad we got to do it. I'm glad, you know, even more so that everybody who participated was so willing and happy to do so. You know, our goal with these isn't to direct anybody else's content or anything else. And it's just, you know, I made a Twitter post about this earlier today, but, you know, thanks to everybody who joined and put out stuff and helped promote each other's shows and stuff like that. But, you know, it'd be so easy with all of us being Green Lantern specific content creators to think that we're competing for an audience. But that's not the case. You know, it's so rare that you find somebody who loves exactly what you love, and loves it so much that they're willing to produce content for free for others to share in what they love. And, you know, Lantern Cast was one of the only ones doing it 16 years ago, but now there are so many others, and it's nice to call them friends and bring them in on this.
We're not the last anymore. We're not the only anymore. So now we can retire, Chad. Thank God. There you go, Dan and Jim. You have it back.
So that ends our coverage of GL June 2024 and the Siege of the Zsharam. But while we have you guys listening, we wanted to talk a little bit about some of what we have coming up for the show.
This is where we insert the crickets now. No, we have a few things. We have a few things in the hopper. For those that would be stunned by this, I should point out that technically Jim and I have actually recorded the end of that Resurrection of Sinestro arc. It's actually recorded and will probably be coming out the week after this one comes out. But yes, that's already done. So surprisingly, we have kept our word, and not only did we record like three times, like in barely over a month, that we did it we probably surprised ourselves.
What are you talking about, Mark, for people who aren't familiar with our show?
Yes, for those who only stick with Lantern Cast proper, that over on in the spinoff, our pre-birth spinoff, which currently focuses on Hal Jordan's time as the Spectre, Jim and I are doing the 3-issue Resurrection of Sinestro arc, which we've already released the first two parts, and we're going to obviously very in short order be releasing the third and final part of that arc, which is one of the more interesting and arguably important arcs in that entire book. How it fits in continuity is always up for discussion nowadays because of Green Lantern Rebirth, but nonetheless, it was a cool fun journey. And anytime I can get Jim excited to do a Hal Jordan Spectre story, it's a rarity, so I take advantage of it. But Chad is mostly now we had. I had this idea. There was an idea. When we were planning on things we were going to do in 2024, and sometimes they just happen to be just random ideas, and sometimes it makes more sense because they match up perfectly, you know, anniversary wise. And because I just bought a hardcover version of Zero Hour, at the end of last year, and Chad has the same one, and we were talking about it. It's like, well, you know, it's the anniversary of Zero Hour is going to be in 2024, so we should revisit that. And we were planning on doing it all along, and then once we found out, hey, it's going to be a 30th anniversary sequel to it, then that made it even more imperative that and gratifying in a way that we were going to do it. So we will be doing a retrospective since there was the original episode 94, correct? Appropriately, yep. Since that's when Zero Hour came out.
It's
that
true.
Episode 94 was the original Zero Hour coverage, which is a really interesting episode by itself. I have to go back and finish listening to it. I listened to, like, I think 3/4 of it last year, long before. When we first
It's a longer episode, is what, 2 hours or something like that?
But... yeah, it's pretty long, and I downloaded it and started listening to it when Chad and I were first talking about that this is something that, yeah, we should definitely aim to do something for Zero Hour. That we will be, so episode 94 is the initial coverage way back when back when Jim and Dan were the straws that stir the drink more than anything else. But so we had
Adam Murdo on from Comic Geek Speak, and the reason we did that is not only is he like a living, I swear he has like an eidetic memory for every comic book he's ever read, but also when Adam was in college, he did his thesis on Crisis, and one of the things that introduced him to comics, he had a big focus on Zero Hour and how important Zero Hour was. So
yeah, since Zero Hour, of course, was the first real sequel. It wasn't the crappy hype you get nowadays for every time they do a Crisis event. How this becomes the real successor, the real sequel, the spiritual successor. This was really DC's first attempt to do anything like Crisis since Crisis. And it was born out of what they felt didn't work, or they didn't quite work correctly in Crisis. So Chad and I are going to be doing this along with Dan. Dan will be joining us. So we will be doing a retrospective and talking about the event, talking about what actually happened in the event. And obviously, from our perspective, I'm sure there'll be lots of specific Green Lantern, Hal Jordan references of and analysis related to what probably is inarguably the most more than Emerald Twilight, that Zero Hour is actually the definitive Hal Jordan parallax moment based on how things played out, because Emerald Twilight by itself would not have been the most difficult thing to explain away without Zero Hour as the follow-up.
Yeah, it's Emerald Twilight, Zero Hour, Final Night.
Yeah. During the parallax time, I would say that is the major events involving. But if you look at what actually defines the real era of Hal Jordan as Parallax, well, much like The Empire Strikes Back, you can make the case Zero Hour is the one that actually is the one that has the most meat on the bones, and the one that actually kind of further absolutely defined and ingrained in people's memory what Parallax was, I think. But we'll talk about a lot of that when we do the episode, but that is coming. No, we haven't recorded it yet, but I'm going the game plan will be probably in the first half of July, I would say at this point. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to take a little more when we're all available to record. That's going to take a little more precedence over another review of War Journal or Green Lantern.
Yeah. Speaking of, guys, we also, you know, for those of you who aren't familiar with our show or aren't regular listeners, we cover, you know, the current Jeremy Adams and Zermanico series. We're wrapping up our coverage of War Journal as that series ends. You know, and we have other things. We have things like our cover to cover, where we talk about each of our top five covers of specific series. We haven't done one of those in a while. Maybe one of those will be coming up soon. I know we want to talk about at some point. We want to do the Godzilla Kong Justice League stuff will be coming up at some point. You know, we have our famous firsts. We did one of those relatively recently, where we talk about some non-Green Lantern stuff, just some comics that we were first introduced to or early in our, you know, comic book reading, I don't know, careers, quote unquote. Emerald Influence, where we talk about stuff that's important to GL history that didn't necessarily come from a Green Lantern proper issue back in the day. Lots of stuff out there for you guys to listen to. So feel free to check out, you know, anything in our feed that jumps out to you as a topic that you want to listen to.
Movie reviews. No, this year is pretty barren of them, but at least we know there will be a Deadpool and Wolverine one on the horizon.
Maybe a Godzilla minus one one. We don't know.
If you watch it, yes.
I have it now. I caved. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I still have to watch it again on Netflix, but yeah, that'd be a good one. Who knows? We may have a Godzilla XCon commentary track in us one of these days.
But anyways, guys, thanks everybody who showed up to listen, who aren't regular listeners. Regular listeners, thanks for being here. Thanks for giving your attention to all the other shows who were involved in this crossover. And GL June will be back next year, God willing. So we'll keep on trucking. But what else do we want to talk about tonight?
So you want to do a little bit of feedback? Yeah, I have it open and just get to it. Let's do Shane's. All right, so we're gonna do a little bit of feedback, not too much today, just because we don't want to stretch it out too much, and we did really want this episode to be mostly the end of GL June. So let's do Shane's, and Shane is talking about, in particular, episode 559, which of course one of Chad's favorites, the end of the Alan Scott miniseries. Hi, Chad and Mark. I made my case for why I disagree with this retcon for Alan Scott last time I emailed, so I won't repeat all of that. Now that the miniseries is over, my question is this. What exactly have we as fans and readers gained from the decision to make Alan gay? In what ways has it made a better character, or has it? In quotes, representation and diversity could easily have been accomplished with a new character rather than making a mess out of Alan's 80-year history. Quote, they can tell new stories about old characters, sure, but they've done that now and it was hardly worth the effort. It wasn't a good story. You two didn't like much about this miniseries, and judging by sales, not many others did either. DC certainly has not gained new readers or made the character more popular. I get that they long ago gave the Golden Age characters flaws and feet of clay, but this series made Alan Scott look especially timid, unsure, and ineffective. Character traits that are exactly the opposite of what is required for the Green Lantern. It turned other characters into shills for his life choices and made his life with his two wives into a lie, which is the opposite of heroic moral behavior. There was not much to admire about this super, quote-unquote, hero in this new story from his past. I think ultimately DC has damaged Alan possibly beyond repair. In trying to broaden and expand his character, they've actually only narrowed it. Now being gay will always be his most prominent and important trait, rather than his heroism or willpower, or even the fact that he was the first in a long line of Green Lanterns. It was a bad decision by DC, but they're stuck with it now. Thanks, Shane. Well, for the majority of what he said, he's not wrong. And that's not really to say he's wrong about anything, but there are some nails I think he hits exactly on the head. The idea that one of the things I really had a problem with was the whole, as he described it, the character shilling for Alan's life choices. There were so many circumstances in that book that were just purposely designed so somebody could pat Alan on the back. And we won't even go back into that Spectre thing of somebody patting him on the back. Just that something led to that moment just so you could have a moment where somebody would say, it's okay, Alan. There's nothing wrong with who you are, which, of course, conceptually, of course, there isn't. But it's just really contrived and self-serving. Yeah, I mean, we have talked about a lot of this. We know that they pretty much have made it clear Alan being gay is what they want you to think of Alan. That's what they want. He was supposed to be their adult male gay poster child, if you will. So that's what they want you to think about the character. Did we really gain anything from that story? I don't know. I do think he was like with my Ship of Theseus concept. He's Alan in some ways physically. And there's some pieces that might still be Alan, but there's so much that's been removed. Is he really Alan? I don't know. But it certainly did not bring in new readers, but that also was arguably an odd. It was almost destined to be that way based on how they approached the story. But
yeah, as you mentioned, there's nothing wrong with him being gay. It's just what it does. It's how you choose to tell that story and what you choose to focus on. I will play minor devil's advocate and say, what have we gained from this? If I were to try and look back and pick something positive, I think one of my favorite things from making Alan gay, and the stories we've gotten so far is how close him and Todd are. Because him and Todd were on the outs forever. He was close with Jenny, Jade, but he, you know, it seems like his relationship with Todd was always very strained. Didn't Todd blame him a lot for not knowing about them or bothering to be with him? Or
I think so.
Yeah. So if I remember that right, and even if like Alan didn't know about them or whatever, and Todd was okay with that, it's just, I think after Alan did know about them, I don't want to say he always tried to interfere with their lives, but he did try to be a dad. But Todd was like, you weren't there. You never earned the right to tell me what to do. So there, regardless of what Todd's thinking or reasoning was behind it, there was always a rift between him and Alan for the most part. There were times when they were close or whatever, but the relationship between Todd and Alan seems to have improved, and that is something I like, especially with all the years of animosity between them. It's nice to see father and son coming together here. So that's minor devil's advocate. I will say that's something we gained. But every time we do get a story with Alan since we got it, like, the focus is talking on his sexuality, which is fine, but if that's all you have to focus on, you know, I don't want to go down this road again. And it's Shane, you shouldn't have written this or anything. I'm not saying that. Thank you so much for the feedback. I agree with a lot of what you said, so on and so forth. But we've beaten this horse to death at this point. And I don't know what I'm not a writer. You know, I once upon a time in whatever sense of, because I try. Very hard, especially specifically with podcasting and content creation, to have a little bit more pride in what I do and self-assuredness. But at one point in my life, I egotistically referred to myself as a good writer. I don't believe that anymore. I was just saying that because I thought it was cool and made me sound interesting or whatever, creative or mysterious, whatever bullshit young people think about themselves at the time when they try to make themselves into something they aren't or interesting. Am I a good writer? Can I write well? Sure. But that doesn't necessarily mean I'd be a great writer for a comic book or a novel or anything like that. So I don't know what DC could do or should do at this point. He's right. He said it was a bad decision by DC, but they're stuck with it now. So if they're stuck with it, what do you do? What do you do to make it interesting? I don't know. I can't tell you. But all I know is focusing solely on his sexuality and his sexuality only, that's not the move. It's okay to reference his sexuality, because anyone's sexuality, romantic history, whatever, is going to be a part of their character and character development, supporting cast, so on and so forth. But it's going to give you opportunities. But if that's all you focus on, that's the problem.
Yeah. And unfortunately, like we talked about with the execution problem versus game plan. This is what they wanted. So right now, that's all they have to say about Alan Scott, which is why they didn't. There was no subtlety. There wasn't the Morgan Freeman approach. Let's talk about everything let's talk about what we have in common. Let's talk about what this version of Alan Scott had in common with the original Alan Scott, and then the minor differences. Hey, you know, he's essentially the same guy. That's not what they wanted. They wanted you to be constantly reminded why this Alan Scott's different. And yeah, so the answer to the question is, how could they do it differently, and how could they, where do they go from here? At some point, if they want it to be not just basically a stereotype, they made Alan Scott almost like a stereotype in a way by trying not to, or in their mind's eye they weren't, but they are. It's by telling stories with Alan Scott that are Alan Scott stories, in which who the hell he sleeps with is not really important for at least 7 out of 10 stories that you're talking about. And playing a little devil's advocate to your devil's advocate related to him and Todd, that's kind of if Todd has all these real deep-seated issues with Alan, which are legitimate, it's also kind of half-assed or kind of narrow-minded to think, oh, he sleeps with the same kind of people that I do, so we have that in common. So that kind of overcomes all the real problems we have. That's kind of a Mickey Mouse approach to it too, and that's not how you would view it, but the way they, how heavy-handed their writing is, that's almost like they would say, well, yeah, they have these issues, but that thing they both struggled with was so strong. I mean, yeah, it could be the little the little crowbar that opens things up between the two of them, but it shouldn't be the be all end all to everything. But
yeah, I think in my mind I was still thinking about that. Was it during Infinite Frontier? Was it a special when Todd and Alan had that conversation in that old bar?
It was either it was either Infinite Frontier or was the one of the Pride specials. But it was one. I want to say the Infinite Frontier one was when they were like it was. I forget where they were talking, because that's when Alan actually came out. So I think it might have been the Pride special. But yeah,
whatever the story was, where we saw Alan meet up with Todd in a building that used to be a bar back in the day. And we had a whole conversation. I do remember Todd expressing some still lingering animosity or uneasiness about his relationship with Alan. So it's not like, you know, Alan being gay solved everything, but maybe it gave him a small to play devil's advocate to your devil's advocate. Did it magically fix anything, everything and everything? No, but I think before Todd didn't have even a minute window into understanding any of the reasoning behind why Alan did what he did. Whether that's because he literally didn't have any way to, he completely misunderstood and had nothing to do with Alan and they couldn't see the same eye to eye on absolutely anything legitimately, or Todd was just doing that because he was pissed and upset and didn't want to see those windows that already existed. He now had one he's a little bit more willing to accept. I don't know. I don't know what those struggles are within the LGBTQ community. So I don't know what that would read as. But, it always felt like Todd had his walls up with Alan and had absolutely no way to meet him eye to eye on any of his understanding about anything. And now maybe he has just a little bit of something he can grab onto that doesn't make him forgive Alan of everything, but makes him understand him just a piece. Whereas he never really tried to understand Alan before.
And in real life, I would buy that more than the way Alan's and his stories are treated with Sheridan and other and everybody. Then mostly, I think, Sheridan in this group. And what's his face? Oh, God, I drew a blank. The guy whose quote made it clear that their plan all along was.
We talked about it at some point during our
I think he was the one who wrote when it became clear that was always idea in a perfect world for that from their perspective that was always going to be the opening salvo and the long-term plan to make Alan gay eventually just everywhere and not straight anywhere. Who's writing that Killing the Children book?
Tynion.
Yes, that's it. Tynion, James Tynion. That's the one. Yes, that's the guy. So the answer to the puzzle was James Tynion. he's the one who made the who had that quote about Alan Scott and the game plan for Alan Scott. That in real life, I would say having that relationship, that commonality, surprisingly, especially when he wouldn't think that was the case. I mean, there was no reason for him to think that you had that in common. I can understand that, but again, because of how heavy-handed and how there's only like one gay experience that seemingly like Sheridan ever wants to explore, like it, not because it doesn't happen, but because it's almost like we have to talk about this one thing, which it's almost becomes almost like the prototypical experience when there's other experiences too that I think it's too convenient. And again, if some of these other things hadn't been in place and we didn't know how Alan's stories have been handled, I would be a little more open-minded about how that would flow naturally. But it just seems a little, again, convenient. But based on that fact alone, but yeah. Just hopefully we won't have a mini anytime soon when we have to worry about it.
Well, I mean, we'll be seeing Alan in Absolute Power, which, I mean, we're sticking in with an ensemble. Carol will be there, so on and so forth. There's a specific kind of like situation where everybody's depowered and everything. So there's a crisis at hand, which I know is a buzzword for DC Comics fans. But like, you know what I mean by that. There's a crisis at hand, something to focus on. So maybe, you know, as much as I'm not looking forward to yet another crossover interrupting things going on in the current Green Lantern series and stuff, maybe we will see some actual character development and focus on the superheroics, the willpower, so on and so forth, of Alan in Absolute Power. We'll see.
It's possible. We'll see. I mean, it would be nice to have Alan Scott just show up as Alan Scott and not having baggage. You know what I mean? That would be cool. Yeah. And if we're going to get one, if we're going to get an appearance, that would be the story that would kind of like, bring it all home.
Yeah. Well, do we have anything else we wanted to talk about tonight?
Well, I'm sure, but we don't have time.
Well, if people want to listen to us, or if any of our new listeners for our crossover want to see more of what we do, how can they find us?
LanternCast.com. The email is LanternCast@gmail.com. So if you like us, you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Hashtag GLCast to track us down there. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, all over the place, wherever you want to. Wherever you do listen to us, please leave us a positive review. If you'd like to leave us a text or a voicemail, 708-LANTERN. LanternCast Vids is our YouTube channel, where we do a whole bunch of things. Card reveals, card openings. We do unboxings. We do a bunch of things. Ring Cyclopedia episodes, always fun.
That's right. Thanks again, guys, for listening. And thanks again to our crossover companions in terms of Emerald Echo over on the Multiverse Musings Podcast Network, the podcast of OA. We got Dan over at Mosaic Comics and, of course, Will over at Green Lanterns Podcast. Thanks, everybody, for participating. And we'll see you next year for the next GL June.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.